Iambic Audiobooks presents The Chaplain, Book 5 of the Alfred Saga by Paul Almond, read by the author. Chapter 1. Reverend John Alfred awoke from frantic dreams of war, brutal soldiers, pure women sabered against pews, babies torn from tender wombs. He sat bolt upright. Where was he? In his boarding house in Quebec City in October 1899. Then what was all this about? Oh, yes, those troops crowding the narrow streets, and rumors that the Boers, in their devilry, had attacked the good Queen's soldiers serving in South Africa. Jack, the nickname he preferred, pushed the images from his mind and dressed quickly. After a good breakfast in his lodging, he hurried along the flat land below the great ramparts of Quebec, the oldest city in Canada. 3- and 4-story houses lined this narrow Rue de Petit Champlain, just as in medieval Bordeaux. He turned up Côte de la Montagne, its steep curves crowded with young soldiers. A calèche rattled past, loaded with rowdy recruits singing, shouting, celebrating their one last leave. Beside him, an overloaded horse dug its shoes into cobblestones as it hauled more revelers up onto the plateau above with its finer houses, important churches, and government buildings. The soldiers wore Glengarry caps and kilts or forage caps, some clad in the regulation rifle-green serge uniforms. All with loyal hearts, Jack could see, having assembled here from all over Canada for their great embarkation. Volunteers, he reflected, who had been activated by the purest patriotism, responding to the call of religion, blood, glory, and progress to fight and bleed for empire's greatest need. These past weeks, ministering to his parishes in northern Quebec, Jack had heard little of the rapidly approaching war in South Africa, nor of the frantic enlistments across Canada. Far from newspapers on their remote but hard-worked acres, his farmers had little means of acquiring news. Only yesterday morning, as he checked in at the cathedral office, had Jack received his first earful. Those alarming reports, and the city busy with excited recruits, had overcharged his imagination and nourished his nightmares. He heard from behind, "Beg pardon, Father." He paused and turned. "Would you know where a fellow might eat a good meal without all that Frenchy sauce?" The obligatory military moustache had begun to grace the young man's lips, but no uniform indicated that he'd just enlisted as he gleamed with enthusiasm. "Took us a long train journey to get here, for sure. Now I'm raring to go, but I gotta eat something." "Go? You're off to South Africa with the troops?" "Monday, they told us. The sooner, the better. No time to lose. Them Boers went and invaded the British colony of Natal. They up and attacked Her Majesty's forces on their own ground." "Really? I did know the Boers sent an ultimatum 3 weeks ago. They demanded a reply from the British within 48 hours. Everyone got in an uproar, so I'm told." "Me too. Those hateful scum went and encircled Colonel Baden-Powell at Mafeking. And they're advancing on Ladysmith. That's why I volunteered. Hard to get in, you know. Lots of fellas got turned down. Too short, too young. Size of chest or fitness, though some got in because of who they knew," he went on proudly. "They say about 1,000 of us is going to get on that there Sardinian Monday." "Quite a force," Jack exclaimed. "Bringing 2 or 3 doctors, some nurses, even a YMCA man, all to look after us. And who is the chaplain, by the way? Someone from Ontario?" Jack wondered if the clergyman in question had volunteered or been selected by his bishop.
"Chaplain? No chaplain, Father."
Jack frowned. "You sure?"
"Yes, Father.
My cousin, he's captain of A Company. We're from Manitoba. Regular churchgoer, so he got complaining last night on the train. The Frenchies, they got one, but we don't.
Jack absorbed that. How dare they send off this young laddie with others his age to face death and suffering without a spiritual counselor?
He pulled himself together and gestured. Now, if you just go on up straight ahead, turn left, and go down Rue Saint-Louis, you'll be sure to find lots of restaurants with whatever you like to eat.
The soldier thanked him and set off. Jack turned right before Place d'Armes and strode up St. Anne Street, now even more worried and still haunted by his dreams. These young Canadians going into battle? How would he have felt if, even before attending university, he'd had to face a murderous foe? Not many hardened veterans hereabouts, just happy-go-lucky fellows with little hint of malice. Here they all were, for the first time in their lives, traipsing up and down the quaint old narrow streets that might have belonged to some crumbling city in Europe. How would they survive against these beastly and bloodthirsty boars? He entered the close of Holy Trinity Cathedral, center of the vast Quebec diocese, an area that included much of Labrador and most of Quebec, five times the size of England. As the seat of the bishop, it drew Jack back every month or so from his little parishes around Lac-Saint-Jean. The cathedral's day-to-day goings-on fell, as was usual, to the dean, Lennox Williams, who'd been born in Lennoxville, where Jack attended Bishop's University. Jack had even coached a bit of rugby across St. Francis River at Bishop's College School, which Lennox had attended, so they might have something in common. But no, on the whole, the dean paid Jack scant attention. And this weekend, the bishop, Andrew Hunter Dunn, would have far too much on his hands, so the dean was his only conduit to resolving the question of a chaplain. Opening the door to the church office, Jack saw his stiff figure bent over the desk of their prim secretary, Margaret.
May I have a word with you, Dean?
Not just now, Alford. We're expecting a packed cathedral tomorrow. Canon Scott is preaching. His high forehead over well-marked dark eyebrows, his dark, heavy moustache, and short, neat beard all signaled a fearsome presence to Jack.
Oh, I look forward to that. So all the troops are Church of England, then?
Mostly, I'd say, mumbled Williams. Some Presbyterians, I'm told, and of course Romans, mostly French from this province. Father O'Leary is leading a low mass for them tomorrow in the Basilica. He's embarking with them, we've heard.
As the dean turned to go, Jack asked, Have you heard who is representing us?
No idea. Whoever he is, he's not preaching tomorrow at any rate.
I've heard they've not chosen a clergyman as chaplain yet.
Impossible, Alford. Of course they have. They must have.
No, sir, I've heard not. The dean, preoccupied with tomorrow's service, was paying little attention. But still, the horror of these young innocents heading off to fight and die for the empire distressed Jack. Did they not deserve succor? Could it be true that not one of the clergy had volunteered? He had no intention of going off himself, but then again, as he reflected, ever since getting his BA degree recently, he had wanted to visit that dark, mysterious African continent. He blurted out, Sir, I'll take the challenge if no one else will. The dean stopped and turned. Now, where did that come from? Jack asked himself. A ghastly mistake? But Jack was not one to shirk a challenge. After spending 2 years in the most inhospitable environment on earth, the Labrador coast, he made up his mind. Let their tramp steamer be shipwrecked, let his regiment be devastated by cannonball or bayonet, let the chaplains be slaughtered by those devil's henchmen, no matter. If he were chosen, yes, he would go.
You, Alford, Lennox Williams snapped. Out of the question. What about your parishioners? How would they get along if you went off adventuring?
The dean shook his head. Can't have one shirking one's duties now, can we? He strode off down the hall and closed his door. So much for that. Jack's shoulders sagged, but he saw Margaret, tight-lipped, watching. A few months ago, he'd even gone so far as to ask her out. His heavy-set athletic frame was shorter than hers, but his large and piercing eyes, although almost black, carried some warmth as they looked into parishioners' souls. Well, with the ecclesiastical taboos on relations with parishioners and his travelling, he'd not benefited from any female friendship since the Labrador, where the lovely Lorna had been a warm confidant before she left. Margaret, though cold as those flows along the St. Lawrence, was at least female. Still unmarried, she was as skinny as a hoe, but ever since she had aborted his attempt at friendship, in his presence she kept extolling neat, handsome, and well-dressed men, which of course quite excluded Jack, with his round, moon-like face and his slightly rumpled appearance. But then Lennox Williams, of a wealthy family, could pay more attention to his wardrobe. For this reason, she seemed partial to the dean, by no means a romantic figure. Perhaps, thought Jack, like him, I should start being unpleasant to her. But in truth, she was about as inviting as an icicle. Jack went to find a more sheltering environment. Up the four cathedral steps he leapt and let himself in through the great oaken doors. For all its plain block-like exterior and bold steeple, the interior was impressive. But Jack didn't notice. He paused at a pew, then slipped through its door and sidled in to kneel. The small doors reminded him that only last year the practice of pew renting had been abolished. He glanced at the bold brass eagle on the lectern from which he had occasionally read the lesson. In the peace of the cathedral, a certain calm descended. After a few moments, Jack bowed his head. The dream images still haunted him. Please, Lord, he whispered, in this great enterprise, make sure our lads have someone worthy to guide them spiritually. He felt strongly that in their righteous battle against such inhuman devils, the soldiers needed a wise and courageous padre. After a time, Jack sat back on his pew deep in thought. Should he press his point? No, of course not. He was much too inexperienced. He glanced up at the balcony to his left, which boasted the country's only imperial box, fronted by a brass balustrade and decorated in royal blue. The monarch's coat of arms reminded him in no uncertain terms of the British Empire, as did the gift given by the king himself over a century ago, solid silver plate, chalice, patens, and candlesticks, all lying in a glass case along the right-hand wall. Jack's country parishes bore no such splendor. One day, he thought, I might be curate here. The doors broke open, and the present curate, Ingle Smith, some 10 years his senior, called out, Ah, there you are, Jack. He came up wearing a worried frown, frizzy hair falling about his ears, but thinning on top, his large and piercing nose supporting thick steel glasses. Jack, I'm frightfully sorry to ask, but would you mind doing me a tremendous favour, in fact, doing us all one? Of course. The bishop has asked me to get these orders of service over to Canon Scott at St. Matthew's. But for some odd reason, I haven't been as diligent as I might, and I'm afraid we don't have enough wine for all those troops Eucharist tomorrow. Our delivery's not till Thursday. Would you mind awfully running down and picking up some? You do know our supplier? Jack nodded. I'd be delighted, Ingall. Although the supplier was a good mile away, Jack saw he had no alternative, and indeed, a good brisk walk might do his spirit some good. Ripping of you, old man. You see, then I must run home and change, because the bishop has invited me, along with the dean,
to the banquet for the officers of the contingent. It's been given by members of the garrison club in the citadel itself. I've never been. Have you?"
Jack shook his head. The citadel, quite a landmark, had been designed in 1820 in the shape of a four-pointed polygon as a defense system. It covered 37 acres and took 30 years to build. Jack would love to have gone, for now it served as the transit billet for the Royal Canadian Regiment's officers heading to Africa. He watched Ingall whirl and hurry out. He had managed to throw not one, but several barbs in Jack's direction. Barbs? How uncharitable! But nonetheless, it did bother Jack that he had not been invited to the citadel. Back at the office, he faced Margaret. Any chance now of seeing the bishop?
None, the secretary confirmed, and pressed her lips together.
Time's a-wasting, thought Jack, repressing his annoyance. He grabbed the money in an envelope she held out for the wine and headed across the cathedral close, passing a railway clerk who came hurrying in, telegram in hand. On impulse, Jack followed him back into the office where the clerk handed his telegram to the church secretary. Savagely, she tore it open. In her floral cottoned frock and prim hairdo, she stared at the telegram and then looked up abruptly.
"You should see this, Mr. Alford, before I hand it to the bishop."
Jack looked down at it. One of his favorite students in his parish of Blue Point, Aino Virtanen, a Finnish lad, had been drowned, along with his father, Heike, in Lac-Saint-Jean. Their funeral was Tuesday. Would Jack please return Monday to perform the last rites? He folded it and gave it back to the secretary. What a shame! Such a fine student and a good family, too!
Return for the funeral?
Oh, yes, he certainly would. Jack walked into the store that already had a goodly share of visitors. Most of them were young men buying supplies to take on the troop ship moored in the harbor. He threaded through the lads to the owner behind the counter, himself a rather portly English member of the Holy Trinity Cathedral.
"I see business is good," Jack offered, "with all the troops arriving."
"Business may be good, but not the soldiers' mission, for sure."
"Oh?"
The storekeeper shook his head. "We've got no business, no business at all messing with people like those Boers. After all, they're colonists, just like us. My wife says it's a crime put on us by politicians and businessmen. They're just trying to make a dollar out of armaments and uniforms and such. You know what? They're after the gold and diamonds there. They want to grab all that through the blood of our offspring."
A voice from behind Jack spoke up.
"What's that I hear?"
A young lad with red hair and freckles had his dander up.
"Say that again."
The plump, gray-haired storekeeper wiped his hands on his apron, looked at him, but did not speak.
"We heard what you said," the soldier went on. "No right to go over there, no right to fight savages who've had the audacity to attack Her Majesty the Queen."
The storekeeper raised his eyes.
"They didn't attack our queen. They defended their land, pushed into doing that by British politicians, Cecil Rhodes, and businessmen like him. They be bigger savages than the Boers, if you ask me."
The red-haired lad tried to interrupt, but the storekeeper kept right on.
"Gold, that's what they want, and diamonds. Once that got discovered in the Transvaal, those businessmen, they sure set their sights on that fortune. Why else go way down there and fight, that greedy bunch? It's their problem, not ours."
"Do you hear that, boys?" the redhead said. "I'm putting back my supplies right now. I'm not buying from anyone who won't support Her Majesty and our fight for freedom."
With that, he dropped his supplies on the floor and stomped out. Jack stared as one after another, the soldiers, some reluctantly, placed their provisions on counters and barrels and walked out too. Jack was left standing, with the storekeeper angrily returning the goods to the shelves. Jack turned. "Are there many that feel as you do?"
"All my wife's family. She's French-Canadian.
They're against our fighting Britain's battles for them. Read the Quebec Telegraph, or the Verite, or even our own Canadian clergymen. They're all against it, too. Not one single French Canadian in Quebec wants this war.
Jack frowned. I've heard a good few French Canadians are leaving with the contingent.
That's as may be. Always fools in any bunch. If you ask me, those politicians in London, Chamberlain and...
He's the colonial secretary?
Yes, sir. And that Lord Minto, our own Governor General, he's British too. Just as bad as the rest. They all want us to go and get shot or killed so's Rhodes and his bunch can get their hands on all the gold and diamonds. That's what my family says. And that's what I say too.
He glanced up.
You have come for wine?
Jack nodded and handed over the envelope from the church office. The man gave him two sizable bottles of port, and Jack went off, head spinning with new thoughts.